Welcome to the Blue Stocking Circle podcast. We're your hosts, Grisel,
Ashley,
and Bea.
And today we will be discussing Gail Carriger's Soulless. Before we start, we should warn you, this podcast is unapologetically rife with spoilers. You've been warned. In today's episode, we will be discussing Gail Carriger's 2009 debut, Soulless, a Victorian romp of preternatural proportion. We'll share our origin stories, do some shipping, have a civilized conversation on the notion of, quote, real literature, air our grievances, and share some highly recommended reading. We hope you'll enjoy today's episode. Soulless holds a particularly special place within the circle, as not only the inspiration for our first episode, but the inspiration for our pod name, the Blue Stocking Circle.
As the one-third of the circle who was a soulless newbie until relatively recently, I would like to give a brief shout-out to my inspiration, Madeline Lengel, and specifically her 2004 New Yorker profile, which was what introduced me to the term Blue Stocking. I didn't know what it meant at the time, but if Madeline Lengel was one, then I wanted to be one too. Now, though, I am all caught up and have seen the soulless light.
And we are excited to have you in the fold. So let's dive right into origin stories, where we share how we came to find the work, in this case, The Wonder of Soulless. So I'm going to start. I really don't remember how I came to this book, but I'm pretty sure it was something to do with NetGalley. I used to be a book blogger, and once upon a time, I would be on every single mailing list for every single new book, because that's what you do when you're a book blogger. Now, I may have seen it featured on NetGalley. I probably more than likely did, or Orbit's website or something like that. So I already had some idea what I was diving into, and I decided to pick up a copy from a book swap site that I used to participate in, and the rest is pretty much history. So for me, Gail Carriger is just basically author goals. The fact that she starts writing this series while also working as an academic. She used to be a professor. And that for me was really inspirational as an aspiring author. The way that she's kind of like made it in my book, no pun intended, is basically just something that gives me all the feels. So I read everything she writes and currently have 4 copies of Soulless, which is more than I will ever need, but bibliophile. There you go.
So. All right, I'm not quite as obsessed as Griselda's because I only own 3 copies in assorted formats. I hope she forgives me. It's kind of the same thing for me. I don't remember how long ago it was, and I don't remember how the conversation came about, but I had a friend who said, oh, you have to read this book. And I was like, oh, okay. And she said, no, you really have to read it. And I said,
did you trust this person?
I did. But I was like, okay. You know, like, I have a lot of books that I have to read because, as you can imagine, I like to read. She made this a non-issue for me because she came in, dropped the book on my desk, and said, read it now. And you're going to thank me on your knees for introducing you to the wonder that is Soulless. Oh. And I said, okay. And I took it home and I read it. And have to say, she was right. I came in the next day saying, this book is amazing. I had already ordered the next 4 in the series. And she said, I told you so. And there you go.
For me, it was a very literal, you have to read this, yes, because we're doing a podcast episode on this.
In other words, we dragged her into a corner and forced it upon her. But now here we are. So let's get started with the conversation by going into our ship wars. And Ashley has some things she would like to talk about. We weren't quite sure how to go about this segment, but it will happen naturally.
Well, what I was talking about, Grisel, earlier here is, for me, there wasn't so much a ship that I really got invested in because, you know, reading this, that Alexia and Connell are endgame. It was sold as a romance. On the back of the book, you know, they talk about her butting heads with him. It's going to happen. And for me, the ships that I really like are the ones that kind of evolve naturally and don't necessarily have to be there. But once you see them coming, you're like, yes, this is amazing. So as we said, there are spoilers in this podcast, so
spoilers everywhere.
Spoilers everywhere. Yes, this is rife with spoilers. For me, one of the ships that I really like passionately follow in Soulless is Professor Lyle, which is the Beta, Connell's Beta. And another character,
I am making a face because are we spoiling future books?
We're not going to because I know that B hasn't read future books and she would probably kill us if we did. So for me, if anyone out there has read it and wants to, you know, like, chime
give
in.
Give us a go.
You know, and chime in on social media, let us know.
At Blue Sock Circle.
You know who I'm talking about, and tell me if you don't agree with me that Professor Lyle is a lovely person and really deserves his own true happiness.
He was my favorite character.
Okay, so you can kind of understand why you really want him to just, like, not be the beta for once. You want him to be the alpha. So no offense, I love Alexi and Kano, but they were quite literally written for each
other.
You knew it was going to happen. When Lyle falls in love, when his ship starts, it's a little different. So you're kind of like, oh, this is perfect. I didn't think about it, but it works.
I am so relieved to hear you say this. I came in today terrified that I was going to be the Debbie Downer of the group because I did not like them at all.
Aww. The two of them together or on their own?
I didn't feel he had enough of a personality for me to evaluate him on his own, but together I did not buy that romance. First of all, you said that it's introduced as a romance in the back cover. I didn't read the back cover. I plunged right in.
This is totally caught off
guard by the fact that this was a romance novel. I felt like the boy in the Princess Bride movie when I got to the page where he kisses her on the street.
About a lady with no soul who was a vampire and had an umbrella.
I thought it was just her going around beating people up with a parasol.
Which is not far from the truth. From her character.
It's very accurate to the first chapter. So anyway, I got to that point and I thought, is this a kissing book? And then I turned the page.
It is a kissing book.
It was a kissing book.
It's a total kissing
book. And a biting book.
It's also a biting book.
So I was caught off guard, and maybe it's because romance as a genre is not one that I'm too familiar with, but I was surprised and not in a good way. I know this is an absurd thing to say about a romance novel, but I would have liked this novel much more without the romance.
Which is something that can bring us to our next point, speaking of. So, welcome to our feminist rant. It is happening now. Now we will smash the patriarchy with a good old dose of lady argument. While Solas itself does not raise my feminist ire, let's have a nice little chat about book shaming or the idea of real literature, in this case, romance as a genre. So, this was inspired for me. Now, obviously, part of the conversation, but when I was trying to think of something to discuss in this segment, I came across an article by Lish McBride on Tor.com, and it is Necessary Whimsy, Combating Book Shame and the End of the World. She's pretty much discussing the idea that there are the right sorts of books, and generally for her, the author, the right sort of book differs wildly, she writes, depending on the person doing the judging. She says, sure, you read X, but that isn't real literature. So here's the thing, she says, that blank, sometimes it was filled with sci-fi, sometimes fantasy, mystery, romance, graphic novels, young adult, middle grade, basically every kind of book I actually liked. And that derision basically just made me dig in my heels harder and read whatever book I damn well pleased. So let's discuss kissing books and the value of real literature.
So, okay, I was kind of, not so much the romance aspect of it, but I had that issue of, oh, this isn't real literature. Even when I would try to explain the book to people, I was always kind of stumped. I would be like, oh, it's this steampunk, young adult, werewolf, horror, comedy, romance thing. And it's interesting because I felt that I was more ashamed. I love this book, but I was more ashamed of describing it because I felt that I sounded silly. And luckily, the people in my life, you know, that's why they're in my life, because they're awesome. They were never like, oh, why are you reading that? But just internally, I was kind of like, oh, this isn't a real book. I'm recommending this. And I was almost apologetic recommending it because I didn't think that it was something that like, oh, why, I'm trying to think how to phrase it. I kind of thought that it was something where I'd have to introduce it as like, popcorn reading, like it's light reading, it's not a real book. And the romance was actually a part of it because I was like, oh, well, they get together and it's romantic, but maybe that sounds silly because it should be ironic. So it's an interesting thing that B is saying, oh, well, it's a romance book. And
But I'm not saying in a disparaging way. It's just one of those genres that I'm not into, like Westerns, for example. Everything you said sounds great to me. Vampires, werewolves, steampunk, I'm there. It was only one particular facet of the story that I wasn't into, and that was specifically the romance between them. And that's in this particular book. And also as a genre itself, I'm not too familiar with it.
So I think that is actually a very interesting factor. So when Solas came out, it was a little revolutionary in some ways because it was coming out on the cusp of like Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. It was this time when there were a lot of steampunk books that were coming out, and it was a new thing in many ways, and it was breaking into really popular literature. You already had urban fantasy, like that was already a thing, but the idea of the Victorian novel slash mystery slash romance slash crime involving zombies and werewolves and all this other stuff was really new. And this book did something different from what was already happening when it tied in the romance element. A lot of these other books tended to focus more on what I think of as the world building of the book, or the mechanics, literally, of whatever machine or whatever terrible, dire thing is happening in the world. Whereas Solus is very satire. It is, in many ways, a novel of manners, and it takes that convention and just, like, explodes it into this whole other thing that subverts the genre, in many ways, in my opinion. And I think taking the romance in particular, because of the idea of you have to apologize for it. Like, a lot of women writers are generally not well regarded in sci-fi and fantasy in particular. There's so much controversy surrounding women writers and what women write and whether it's worthy of recognition and just being recognized within, you know, the world of literature in many ways. I think what she was doing here, because she was taking something that was so traditional and just like spinning it on its head, was in many ways revolutionary. And I love that she does have the romance element, because it's kind of like, I'm just going to do all these things that people are usually like, should like just like tearing women down for, and I'm going to do it. And she totally did it. And she became so popular for it. And it became a bestseller when I think she probably didn't expect that to happen when she published it. I know that she had like self-published some stuff before this came out, but I don't think she expected it to blow up in the way it did. And that's what I truly find revolutionary in this aspect, especially because, yeah, we even ourselves will sometimes apologize for reading this kind of book. And I know that that's kind of like my secret feminist agenda, where I'm like, I read trash literature and I'm okay with that. But it took me a long time to be okay with that. That's my soapbox.
I guess I might as well confess. Okay, confessing what we read. I love the article you shared about reading Whimsy, and I've never confessed this to anyone, but I have read all of Christopher Moore's books, every single one, and I buy all of his books the day they come out.
That's amazing.
That is totally cool. You would not admit to anybody. The circle is a safe place.
There have been, in fact, 3 books over the course of my lifetime that have made me laugh so much I had to put the book down because I was physically incapable of reading, and 2 of those 3 were the first 2 recommendations on that list, Jasper Ford and Christopher Moore's books.
Oh, Thursday Next, I could not get through that without having to take breaks to breathe, because I was just laughing and I was like, okay, wait, oxygen, okay, continue.
The Nursery Crime series is also fantastic, and I feel it's very underrated, so I want to give it a shout out here now.
Good shouting.
Okay, so I have a question for B, since we're talking about the romance aspect of it, and you said you didn't like that part of it so much, which is totally cool, but I'm wondering what you think about the fact that she had her female lead engage in, shall we say, more forward thinking acts, and she's someone who's a little bit more sexually active than definitely any woman.
She's a scarlet woman.
She is a scarlet woman, yes. Definitely in the world of Solus, in the world of Victorian London, as it was. And then even in a lot of books today, a lot of times mm-hmm. when you have 2 characters fall in love, oh, it's just like kind of like platonic, they kiss and then they're married and that's it. And you don't have a lot of like build up and, hey, let's do other things instead of just kissing. So do you think there's any, not worth to it, but what do you think about that aspect of the romance?
It definitely caught me by surprise. I don't read much Victorian literature that's not actually written in Victorian times. And mm-hmm. obviously that's not a part of any of those novels.
No.
I don't know what to say. I just did not like them as a couple, no matter at any stage. I never felt that he respected her. I never felt that she knew anything about him other than he was attractive and that he once sat on a hedgehog. There's one point in the book where she says that she's realized he has 2 states. He's either annoyed or aroused. And clearly that was enough for her, but it wasn't enough for me to buy them as a couple. Maybe if it had been sold as a purely physical relationship, mm-hmm. maybe that I would have been convinced by. But the fact that it was sold as a romance leading up to their marriage, that's what I didn't buy.
Speaking to that point, I think this is something, it's a convention in romance fiction in particular. And it's very common in historical romance where you generally have I think it is in some ways derived from like Mr. Darcy. Like a lot of historical romance writers go back to Mr. Darcy as like the model of, or Mr. Rochester as like the model of the male hero who is in many ways a terrible human being when you really think about it.
And so he's redeemed and by he's redeemed. The female that he falls
but
in love with.
But there's that, I think in that aspect, it's part of the satire of it where Alexia is like saying, you know, he's usually either aroused or annoyed. And that's usually what is associated with Mr. Darcy. Like he's either like really turned on by Elizabeth or he's really annoyed by Elizabeth. But historical romance writers do that all the time. And that's one of the big problems with historical male leads, especially in romance, because you're like, why is this guy supposed to get the girl when he's kind of a jerk? It's problematic fiction.
I am still angry about Jane Eyre and Mr. Rochester. And that was written about a century before I was born.
These are all problematic things.
But you two are much more familiar with this genre than I am. What are your thoughts coming from that perspective?
So it was different for me rereading it now for the podcast. I remember the first time that I read it, I was like, oh, cool. This is something where not only is the male, is the Mr. Rochester type, is being annoying and aggressive and sexually forward, but you know what? The female is too. And normally the female is kind of passive. She sits back and she either avoids the advances or she's just so angelic that they kind of go over her head. And just her mere presence makes him a better person. So the fact that Alexia battles him back and she did put the hedgehog there for him to sit on, even though she didn't mean to, and that she is just as aggressive, and I love her, but she can be annoying too. She's very headstrong and very stubborn. So the fact that she was kind of demonstrating these traditionally male hero characterization, I really like that. Reading it again for this, I took a slightly different track. And then I was like, you know what? Like you said, there's one point where he says, you know what? Alexia, she's thinking about her. And he's like, why wouldn't she get married? Why haven't I gotten married? Well, Alexia's there and she's not that bad. So there's a little bit of his internal monologue where it almost kind of seems as if he decides to fall in love with Alexia because, and the same thing happens with Alexia, and that bothered me a little bit, but then I thought, you know what, why not? Not that there's a lot of talk about like how feminist Alexia is. She is a feminist type for her time, but there's a point, it's a small spoiler for the second and third books, but nothing that will, you know, like
be life shattering.
They're talking about the vote in England, and she says something, well, I don't need the vote. I already have a different type of vote, and I already take care of my husband, and I'm fine that way. And it's cool. There's little things. I'm like, well, how feminist is she? Again, it's a lot of satire because a lot of women were like, we don't need the vote because why, you know, why bother? But the fact that both of these characters kind of are flawed characters and they decide to, hey, fall for each other anyway is really refreshing. Because the whole trope of like, oh, someone walks into a classroom and they see this girl sitting there and, oh my God, it's true love. Or the girl walks outside and the guy is strolling by and, oh, true love. So that kind of thing where you almost can't help it is irritating. But the fact that these two kind of go around that, I thought was interesting.
This is my second confession of the day.
We're good with that.
I did not connect with Alexia. She was presented as a wealthy, fashionable woman. I loved her introduction. She was active. She was resourceful. She had a laser focus on food, which I very much relate to. And then for me, it was kind of all downhill from there. Because she was presented as being special because she's soulless. She was presented as being doubly extra special because she's a female soulless. She had all these wonderful strengths and qualities. And then the book, to balance that out, kept mentioning her flaws. And her flaws were that she's voluptuous, she's witty, and she's tanned. So she's Kim Kardashian on the outside, and she's Tina Fey on the inside. And viewed through a 21st century American lens, as I was, these are not flaws.
I think that's actually really funny. So when I read the book the first time, and I think now as well, even reading it again, what I enjoyed the most was really like the comedic like one-liners. And Alexia has a lot of those. But the Brown thing stood out for me more this time reading it. I think because maybe when I was very recently out of grad school when I read this first, the first time, because it was 2009 that it came out. So I was like recently out of an English program. The Brown thing, the voluptuous thing, I already knew as things that were considered flaws in the Victorian era. So I didn't connect with that. But when I read it again this time, it really stood out to me because I'm like a little bit more hyper aware of especially like the way that color is treated in literature now. I'm more aware of like those subtle cues of racism and classism and all that. The brown voluptuous thing, I know why it's a thing, and in many ways it's very much tied to the author, which goes to your theory of Mary Sueishness, because it's there. But yeah, brown and dark hair and Italian features and voluptuousness were like considered hypersexual by the Victorians. And what we think of as brown to them is like, well, you slightly freckle in the sun. But it was definitely a flaw. And it comes up a lot in George Eliot. So I think because I was so part of that world, I wouldn't have caught it at the time. But reading it again, I totally picked up on that. And I was like, she's just a little darker skin. She's like olive, maybe. Why? Why a flaw?
See, and I think it's interesting. I didn't have that background of, oh, yes, these are flaws to the Victorians, although I probably could have thought about it had I added a little bit more critical thinking to it. For me, I liked them because they made me identify more with her. Because the way that I picture Lexi in my head, she's not particularly pretty. And when they say voluptuous, they say at one point that she falls on Lord Macon and he's like, oh, get off, because Alexia is not a small woman. And as someone who is not a small woman, I would never be the picture of traditional Victorian beauty, even traditional Western beauty. The fact that her skin is a little darker and that she's not 95 pounds and that she's not traditionally pretty. To me, I took that as, oh, great, this is a character. And she's also a little bit older, too, than traditional heroines in historical fiction. I kind of took that as things where I could identify with her because this was a character that seemed to be closer to who I was. So yeah, I see that there falls in definitely in terms of like skin color and race mm-hmm. and how it's portrayed. I do see how saying that she's darker is, and that is a flaw to them, can be problematic. But I was like, oh, great. This is someone who looks more like me than anyone else in historical fiction, and I like it. So it's interesting to kind of put
we both went into different directions.
Yeah.
That's cool. To echo on both your points, I agree that she's a wish fulfillment character, and I understand the appeal of her, but those weren't my wishes she was fulfilling, so I never made that connection with her, first of all. And then second of all, as to your point, I understand these are flaws in Victorian England from that perspective, as you meant the race issues, the class issues that were present at that time. But I never felt that the book was immersed in that setting. I always felt the author's 21st century American tone and I was reading. And I think that was intentional. There were many anachronisms sprinkled throughout the book for comedic effect. For example, one of the vampires told Alexia, oh, she tried to make a funny. The characters began their sentences with and gee all the time, which would not happen in that time period.
Right.
Or things like even Alexia making double entendre, such as hard versus difficult. Oh, Victorian young lady would never make such a double entendre. These are all very modern turns of phrase. So because that was kept very present throughout the book, that I was reading this in the year 2017 in the United States, and the voice of the book didn't dissuade me otherwise, I could never buy that these were actually flaws in the character. I felt these were modern traits that were beneficial, but that they were being in a mocking tone used to balance out her strengths. The end result of that for me was that she had no flaws. She was a perfect character in every sense, despite what the book was telling me. So when she fell into these moments of self-pity, I started rolling my eyes a little, and especially as the book went on and she got more and more advantages. Queen Victoria herself, Lady Catherine the Burgh, her way into the house to give her a super secret special government position and to make recommendations about her love life. That was a point at which I realized I was not going to be fond of her.
So I think we're good to jump into Catharsis Corner because we're going into that direction anyhow. And I have a point to add. So let's dive into Catharsis Corner, where we will air our feelings with a cup of tea and discuss many of the issues we've already been discussing, mainly blue stocking spinster's privilege, or in other words, class, money, and sex. So, one of the things that I noticed, because this is the first time that I read the manga, I had never read the manga before, and a lot of the elements that we just discussed, Alexia's brownness, her voluptuousness, and the emotional self-pity comes through very differently in the manga.
This is true.
And while I enjoyed the manga, I read it and then I was reading the book at the same time. So simultaneously, I was kind of like going through the same scenes and I was like, this totally changes the meaning and not necessarily in a good way. So there is one scene in the manga where it's the scene that Ashley mentioned. Connell says to Lyle, like, oh, why isn't she married yet? And in the book, it's kind of like just like, they're annoyed with each other, and he's just kind of like, if she were married, she'd be out of my hair. Like, you know, some guy would be dealing with her, and I wouldn't have to like deal with hedgehogs and all that mess. But in the manga, she overhears him and kind of like goes off to a corner and looks like she's crying about it. And that doesn't ever come across as the Alexia of the book. So I thought that was an interesting element to change in the manga. And her voluptuousness is also of a different nature, whereas in the book, I do picture her as like slightly heavier for Victorian era. Not so much hourglass as, like, you know, there's more to her. She's maybe swarthier, or she's got more of, there's physically more of her. Her physicality is emphasized a lot. Her eating is emphasized a lot, which is definitely stuff you don't associate with the traditional Victorian woman, because there's the idea of tiny cinched waist, you don't eat a lot.
She's a waif,
she's petite, and she faints every time. Alexia does not faint. She faints on purpose. But that is very different in the manga, because they just mostly made her of, B was earlier calling her the Kim Kardashian of the novel. And in the manga, she does kind of look like she's got Kimish features. Like, she's very boobyish, and she's very, like, voluptuous on the bottom, but she is a tiny girl and very traditionally manga-esque, like of the sexy manga style, but very different from what I picture in the book. So let's talk about sex. Alexia is very bold. And not something you would normally associate with a girl of this era. Like, normally you think of the young Victorian woman protecting her virtue, especially class. I think the difference in disparity between her and Ivy in particular, Ivy is very scandalized by everything that Alexia does. Ivy's also of a lower class. Her parents probably couldn't save her if she engaged in similar behavior. There's a lot of Alexia's story that Ivy doesn't know, so she doesn't know why Alexia is special or any of that other stuff. But you definitely get the impression that were Ivy to be in a similar situation, things would not go so well for her. Thoughts? Ideas?
Yeah, I think a lot of what Alexia can get away with is, like you said, is because of her privilege, of her position. If Ivy came home after spending all night with a man, I think it's interesting because I don't think Ivy would even... There's a difference in whether or not Ivy would even have been given the option of marrying that man to save her reputation. I think as a lower class, you know, female, Ivy might have been just written off as, you know, lost forever. Whereas Alexia, her mom throws a fit and her mom is like, you have to marry him to save whatever reputation you have left. And I think it's interesting, too, that a lot of what Alexia does, or a lot of what Alexia knows, and thereby what she does, is due to her father. Her father left her his library, and there are drawings in there that aren't quite to scale, and she's very interested in exploring all those things. But her father left her that, and her father, as you're told, you know, very often, was an Italian, was an outsider, was a foreigner, and everyone makes comments on that. So even then, she has the protection of she's doing these things, and she knows these things because she's not of the normal Victorian family. She had this person in her life who gave her this information, so she can almost blame it on him. Like, oh, well, my father was different. That's why I'm different, and I can do these things. And you can't blame me that much because of my background, which is something that she can do. But what does Ivy have to fall back on if she wanted to engage in the same types of behaviors?
And I think that's also problematic because when you think of it as, you know, this is all acceptable because my dad was a little off because he was Italian.
I was just thinking that. Fetishization of the other. Exactly. How much of this do or is attributed in the book to her Italian
to
background?
Her Italian
if
background.
She was fully English girl, would we be seeing the same Alexia?
It's the Latin in her.
Well, and this comes out, too, in a lot of how Connell's portrayed. How many times do they say, oh,
he's Scottish.
He is a werewolf. Therefore, he just acts like a ragged, big he-man person because he is Scottish and he can't be expected to act any differently. Mm-hmm. So that's another thing, too. And to the Victorians, Scotland was the other.
It was the wild place.
It was the hinterland. Yeah, it was the wild where you were exiled to. You didn't really want to go there. Queen purchasing Balmoral, you know. Changed it a little bit. But yeah, I noticed that too, rereading it, that there's so many times where Connell is portrayed as rough and aggressive. And not that it's okay because he's Scottish, but because he's Scottish, he cannot be expected to know any better. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, really? I mean, do you guys really? And again, it's a satire thing, but it's an interesting way
of... But at the same time, it's still...
It's leading into stereotypes.
Yeah.
And I felt the same with Lord Akodama. He was leading into the stereotype a bit too much.
See, with him, I wasn't quite so struck by it. It was a lot, but because of how he's written as someone who was like a spy master and you never quite know where he stands, I almost felt as if he knew that he was being too much and the character was being too much on purpose to throw off everyone around him. Because, okay, well, if he's just this really flamboyant dandy or whatever word you want to use, you can't expect him to know the things that he does. So I felt like that one, the character almost took on a life of his own.
Like he purposely makes himself exaggerated so you don't take him seriously.
That's an interesting perspective. As you were talking earlier, I was reminded of Lydia Bennett and that whole kerfuffle that resulted when she ran off with Wickham, and how in the book it's presented as this calamity for Jane and Elizabeth. They have nothing to do with it, but as you said, the whole family is ruined by association because of her behavior. And I was also wondering how much of this is a product of Alexia's age. She's about a decade older than traditional Victorian heroine. Do you think that plays a factor into the fact that she's more experienced, so to speak, in knowledge, if not in action?
I think there could be a little bit of that. I think, again, the book kind of excuses it as her curiosity, and she's been reading, because, you know, reading is very dangerous, which is also definitely a trope that was used to keep girls from reading in the Victorian era and before also. So there's always the danger of books. Bookish women, blue stockings, are very dangerous because they know too much. I think there's also something to be said for the fact that I think she assumes she's going to be a spinster forever and she wants to experiment. It is not unheard of. It would have been uncommon, but it would not have been completely unheard of in the Victorian era for an older woman, maybe a spinster, particularly of class. You wouldn't see this normally in the lower classes. There would be more of a danger in the lower classes. You know, if you were just sleeping around, you were probably just a prostitute, or you were maybe already married, had children, were a widow or something, and were now having a relationship with somebody else. But it's not unheard of for particularly a woman of the aristocracy to have taken a lover. So there could be that. She could have gotten away with it, even had she not married him.
And there's interesting, talking about sex and privilege, I was trying to find exactly where it was in the book. At the end where she and Connell are locked in the room and they're, you know, having fun, at one point he says to her, well, do you think that I would engage in acts of this sort with a woman of your stature without planning to marry you? And that segues into another conversation about marriage between the two of them. But having talked a little bit about it, I think it's interesting that I had read it, but it hadn't really registered. Okay, so he's engaged in acts of these sort before, but which, cool, knock yourself out, but not with women of her stature, meaning because her stature is where she is, once again, she's protected, whereas someone else could maybe also have fallen in love with him and engaged in acts of these sorts and not had any recourse to fall back on when everything was done because they were just too low class to expect marriage as payment, as the ultimate, you know, culmination of what they were doing. So it's interesting that even the characters themselves slightly address this, and they realize, whether it's as conscious as we're talking about it now, they do realize that what they're doing is based a lot on class and stature, which is so tied into Victorian England that even in a satire, steampunk, romantic comedy thing, you can't escape it. So that's an interesting way to look at it.
There is a reason why Gretna Green was such a popular destination. Any final thoughts?
Well, I do want to highlight what we found positive about the book.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. So not just because we've had a lot of discussion, critical thingy, does not mean that ultimately we didn't like the book. As we said before, I have three copies. Grisel has four.
I love
four.
This book.
Yeah, we do love the book.
I can still engage it critically.
Okay. So then, since we do love it, what are some things, as the newcomer, that you did like about it, if there was any?
There were lots of things I enjoyed about the book. One of them was the world building. I love the little details she put in, such as the fact that drapes are in style because vampires are considered fashionable, and vampires, of course, need heavy drapes in order to block out the sun. They lend a realism or a verisimilitude to the world that I appreciated. I liked the tone of the book. I thought it was very charming. I loved the pace of it. I read it in two sittings, and I would have read it in one, except it got so late the first time because I was reading the book so quickly that I had to go to bed and finish it the next day. So I did enjoy the book. I thought it was very entertaining. despite all the Debbie Downer moments I've had today.
But if you didn't love something, you wouldn't want to engage with
exactly.
it so much.
I think if you don't appreciate something, you just kind of read it and pass it on and you're done and you mm-hmm. never think about it again. We've had a lot of thoughts.
Oh, I did want to ask you something. The mystery. Did you guys figure it out the first time you read it?
Did I? I think I remember if I go back far enough, I knew enough about golems to have had some knowledge of what the monster was, but I don't think I knew enough about the society surrounding it and other things that I won't go into because there's more. So spoilers. But
do they do explain the octopuses?
Yes.
Does it end in the book that the octopuses were never explained?
You do. You yes. do get more of a...
There is more. So yeah, I got enough, I think, that... Because I do like to read mysteries, so you can follow enough of the thread. And I remember, like, figuring out what the monster was at some point, but I don't know if I had all the pieces in place by the end of it.
I totally didn't, I'll be very honest. I am not someone who can read a mystery and say, oh, well, this is going to happen because of this. I'm very much a... I can't believe this, even though there were 25,000 clues leading up to it. Yeah, so in retrospect, I can kind of piece it together. When I was reading it, the only thing I do remember figuring out was, oh, when she wipes off the I from Vixie instead of the whole word, mm-hmm. right then I was like, oh, having no idea what this was, I was like, that's not going to work because this was Latin and I know mm-hmm. enough Latin to know that Vix was another Latin word.
Declensions.
Right, exactly. So I was like, whatever type of technology you're using, it's not going to happen with the way that you're dealing with it. So that part I knew that she actually had to wipe out the whole thing
For
it to actually work.
How did you feel about the mystery? Did you figure out the mystery?
I figured it out on page 89, according to my notes, she was with my people at the dinner party. I did not figure out the homunculus, even with your clues about clocks and how you got excited because of the clock sound effects. And I only figured out the mystery because it reminded me of another book
okay.
in which children are disappearing instead of werewolves and vampires, and it turns out that researchers are capturing them in order to experiment on their souls.
I know the book you're talking about.
Okay, we all know this book.
So I made the connection right away, which is the only reason I figured it out.
Oh, that's smart. I hadn't thought of that. I'm trying to think. My favorite part of it, I do like the world building, and that's kind of when you go and you read a little bit more about Gail Carriger. She says that this whole thing kind of started by her trying to explain history. How could this tiny little island that's always wet and rainy mm-hmm. conquer the whole world? Well, obviously, because werewolves were the army. And that kind of going from that. So, yeah, like the drapes, the fact that the Beau Brummel high collars mm-hmm. and ascots are in style is because, hey, what better way to hide a bite mark on the neck than? So I like that. And I really like the supporting characters. I think that they're really rich. You have Flute, you have mm-hmm. Ivy, you have Lyle, even the sisters and the parents. Mm-hmm. It's just the first book, so a lot of them are given a lot more characterization and really like a really rich backstory the more you read.
I think the first book plays it safer and keeps it more to just the couple.
Right.
And the romance, because maybe, I don't remember the whole story, but I don't think they thought it would go beyond the first book. So I think there's something but it does develop a lot more. And I think those side characters especially become
really,
really funny.
Important and really interesting by just even having them there, like to give Alexei a friend who is lower class and scandalized, but still supports her and wears crazy clothes and tells Alexia, hey, I don't like how you dress. And Alexia tells her, hey, I don't like how you dress. Like, that's how I talk to my friends. So it was very much like a very, maybe 21st century, but a very real female relationship that I could relate to. And I was like, oh, I like that. I like giving her a father who's not a father and like a father who never says anything, but manages to tell her exactly what he wants her to know. I just like really like the rest of the characters in there.
I really liked what you said. I like that there was a female friendship in this book. Mm-hmm. In so many of these supernatural stories, there's one well-developed female character if we're lucky. Here we had two and enough to have a strong friendship between them.
And
so I really
more
appreciate
to come.
That. Good. Does she get a personality beyond the love of ugly hats? Because I liked her. What little we saw of her, I really liked
her. There's a lot to Ivy. And there's another character who is my favorite character. And I didn't remember that character is not in book one. Goggles.
You can say it. I won't know who it is.
Madame
Yes.
Okay. She's not.
She's not in this one. And for some reason, I think I had subverted all the books into one. And I was like, oh, that's right. She's not in this one yet. But she's in the finishing series.
And that's another strong female.
You'll get her even if you read it. It's a very strong female character.
And
really
good. Make a prediction?
Go ahead.
Go for it.
Is Alexia's father a ghost?
No.
Oh, okay. Hope's dashed. I thought you had more of a presence.
No, that would not work.
I figured he's either alive, but then it can't be because then her mother would be committing bigamy, and I don't think people go that far in the book. So I figured maybe he's a ghost because we heard a lot about them, and we heard that one's an employee.
Yeah.
That's interesting that you picked up on that, because there's a whole, that's just the very beginning of a thread that leads to a whole tapestry the more you read. So there's a lot in there.
There's a lot more to the father and the story. And I always wanted to know more about the mother. Like, that's one of the things I always regret, because throughout the whole series, I don't think you ever find out about Alexio's mother. And you're like, how did that happen?
I was wondering that. Why would she marry him if she's so disdainful of Italians and everything that her daughter inherited?
Still don't really know that one.
I think it's just a Mr. Bennet, Mrs. Bennet type thing.
Maybe.
Maybe. It could be.
I was pushing more as like a, she went away, not on spring break, but the equivalent of spring break. And it was one of those like vacation romances that turn into a thing. And you get home and you're like, oh.
Summer loving
that you can't like escape when fall comes. You got a ring on the finger and they don't divorce in Victorian England. That's how I pictured it in my headcanon.
Gail is hearing this. Give us the story, please.
We're really interested. We're only asking because we're really curious and we're just dying to know.
We need to know. How did that happen? Okay, I think we're good. So,
book recommendations?
More recommendations for more things to read.
Now that we've shared so much goodness, we don't want to leave you empty-handed. There are many recommendations I would like to make, but I have limited myself to three options. Firstly, for those who really enjoy the sexy paranormal mystery elements of Solace, give a go to the Darkest London series by Kristen Callahan, which starts with book one, Firelight. If you really enjoy the steampunk neo-Victorian elements of Solace, have a go at the Immortal Empire series by Kate Locke, which starts with God Save the Queen. And for those of you who just really love a book on manners and magic, try Sorcery and Cecilia by Carolyn Stevermer and Patricia Reed, or really just about anything that either of those writers has written.
If, like me, your favorite part of Solace was the world building, then I strongly recommend another supernatural alternate history of England in the 19th century, which is Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell by Susanna Clarke, as well as the accompanying short story collection, The Ladies of Grace Adieu, and other stories. It's lesser known, but it does have more of a female focus than Jonathan Strange. Both of these books are excellent and have the Blue Stocking seal of approval, given that so much of them revolves around books and libraries and the competition for these books and libraries. In addition, you may have heard of the very popular recent BBC series based on Jonathan Strange. Even though it is well done and rather faithful to the book, I still recommend seeking out the book if you can, because Susanna Clarke plays with the text in a very unique way, such as the excessive use of footnotes to add details to the world that she builds, and it also has excellent illustrations.
I know Griselle talked about Sorcery and Cecilia by Caroline Stevermer and Patricia Reed. I love Patricia Reed. She wrote, it's an omnibus now called A Matter of Magic that has a strong female protagonist, has strong female secondary characters, has a male lead who is not a traditional male lead, and it's refreshing to find someone who does not fit the Mr. Darcy, Mr. Rochester roles, but is still set in Regency England, so he has some of those...
He has those traits.
Traits to work with. So if you want another book recommendation by Shereen, A Matter of Magic. Highly recommend.
Happy reading. You can find the Blue Stocking Circle online at thebluestockingcircle.com or on Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest, and Tumblr at Blue Socks Circle. That is Blue S-O-X Circle. Or you can email us at thebluestockingcircle@gmail.com. So thank you guys for joining us today on the Blue Stocking Circle podcast. Join us for our next mini episode on September 15th, where we will be discussing feedback, first impressions, and recent favorites.
Cheers!
Who's doing the introduction?
Episode one.
But this is forever.
Welcome to the Blue Stocking Circle podcast.
Okay. Okay. Should we do it again?
No.
No.
We're just editing all this out.
Okay.
Someone is very loud.
Probably me.
Or me. I laughed.
No, I think we're fine. It was just our laughter.
I mean, if someone's going to be loud, it's going to be me, because...
I think this is our blooper.